I expect you to be watching every night this week at 8 o'clock. Now, when we go on satellite, when we go on satellite on Sunday, I will be trying to catch them up with us slowly. With you, we have been following the lost tribes for some time. We know the problem that made them become lost to history, but not to God. They just weren't called by the same name wherever they went. When they ended up in Assyria in bondage, they were called the house of Qumri. When they ended up in Persia, they were called the Saki or Sakasuni. They then were encountered by the Greeks as Cimmerians, Sumerians, or Scythians. Now, the Scythians were a lifestyle taken because the lifestyle was carried on in a certain place as a nation and later designated as a territory. But the word Scyth comes from Scyth or Scoth, which means booth, which they'd pick up and reassemble. And it simply was a generic term for a wanderer, same as nomad designates a lifestyle. If the same nomads wander in the same place long enough, you'd call it nomad land. And after a while, it'd become the country of the nomads. That's what happened with the Scythians. And these tribes recognized by Esdras in the Apocryphal book as determining to go north to a land where they could live by their own laws rather than come back to Samaria. And for a year and a half, because of the multitude, with great noise, passed through the gate in the headwaters of the Euphrates River through the Caucasus Mountains. They appear as the Celts north of the mountains, as the Scythians, north of the mountains. But God gave some clues for those that look for them. History is starting to uncover the background of the Celts or Celts, and many misunderstandings are beginning to pass by. It was 721 B.C., 721 B.C., that the ten tribes were carried into bondage in their worst loss. But there were tribes ahead of them. The half-tribe of Manasseh and Reuben and Gad, two and a half tribes had been carried into bondage years before that, settled among the Medes and the Persians on the border of the Assyrian Empire, particularly among the Medes, between the Caspian and the Black Sea, south of the Caucasus Mountains, some of them on around the Caspian Sea, on the Iranian side. It took archaeology digging into those remote border stations to find the references to these people and to learn they weren't just carried as slaves, chained together, but they were resettled in the territory because the Medes comprised a troublesome frontier. And border guards wrote reports of them. Some of them began to serve as mercenaries for the Medes in their rebellion against the Assyrians. Others served as mercenaries on the side of the Assyrians in various border skirmishes. Some of them rebelled against Assyria themselves. Darius names that. But the vast multitude went through the gates of the Caucasus Mountains and settled near Ararat and the steppes and plains in southern Russia between the Black and Caspian Sea. This vast immigration would occur around 700 B.C. on one side or the other of it. Early 7th century, close of the 8th century. They then would begin to move westward, as tribes would attempt to divide up the territory among their descendants and pressure would move them on. And most of northwestern Europe, we now know, was populated by the Celts. I pulled this little book by Nora Chadwick out before. Nora Chadwick held appointments at many universities throughout the British Isles. One of the world's great experts on the Celts. Married to Hector Monroe Chadwick, professor of Anglo-Saxon at the University of Cambridge. Most of her life spent doing research, mainly into the Celts. University lecturer in early history and culture of the British Isles at the University of Cambridge. Lectured at universities of London, Edinburgh, Wales, Oxford, and Durham. No British Israelite. Just a student of the Celts. It may be accepted, she says, that the Celts had emerged by 500 B.C. as a recognizable people in Central Europe. That's only 100 years away from their settlement north of the Caucasus and beginning to expand. I'll pick some things about Northwest Europe as we broke away from the digging only in the Mediterranean and what is called the Greco-Roman centers of the world. And the digs in Northwest Europe and Central Europe begin to uncover its history. They break the ancient ones down by the artifacts. Beaker people who used beakers, I'll have more to say about them when we move to Ireland, and the battle axe people. And it was the Celts welding their battle axe. Now, isn't it interesting that God calls the descendants of the Joseph people his battle axe? And yet it is the battle axe. It characterizes these people as they move across Europe. The cultures of Northwest Europe begin with the Unitice culture. So far back, I don't want to mess time with it. Then the Tumulus culture, characterized by the way in which they buried their dead. Followed by an indigenous group in the area, as best we can determine, called the Urnfield. And you can figure that out. Named because they cremated and buried their people in urns and fields. Urnfield culture. And it was the Urnfield people that suddenly are shoved aside by a battle axe welding or wielding group of Celts. They crash on to the scene in Europe. It took digs in Austria and Switzerland to finally uncover the real culture of this people and open up the interest of digs until we begin to understand the Celts. Hallstatt is a village in the Salzkammergut in Austria at which was found an important cemetery. Latin, or Latine, is situated near the northeastern end of Lake Neuchâtel in Switzerland. Interesting dates. In general terms, the Hallstatt culture in Central Europe existed approximately from 700 to 500 B.C., that's the period when these Celts, characterized by what was dug up at Hallstatt, where they dug burial grounds where the leaders were buried in their wagons, with the trappings of their horse, with their weapons. The dominance of this group sweeping out of the area north of the Caucasus is from 700 to 500 B.C. Nobody knows where they came from. Just all of a sudden, boom, like a flower growing out in the desert, these battle axe warriors, the Celts, with the culture uncovered at Hallstatt, sweep across Central and Northern Europe between 700 and 500 B.C. That's too close a time. Where'd they come from? When other records show these 10 tribes in a multitude so noisy and so big that it took a year and a half for them to pass through the Caucasian passes, north of the Caucasus Mountains, to settle in those steppe lands and then begin to move 700 to 500 B.C. No accident, I'm telling you. But as they come across this territory, Sumerians, just a derivative of the term Kimri, those of the earlier house of Kumri, conquered by the Assyrians, who moved around the southern edge of the Black Sea and up into the western territory west of the Black Sea to settle. Then the main body of them goes through the Caucasus Mountains 50 to 75 years later and settles between the Black and the Caspian Sea. And they then put pressure on the Cimmerians, or Sumerians, a derivative, as I've said, of the house of Kumri, which comes right out of the Assyrian bondage. They press in wave after wave, the Sumerians first and then the Scythians, both Celts, blonde, fierce warriors, believers in an afterlife, headhunters, cutting heads off just like David cut it off of Goliath. We've been over all of this territory as we've covered what does a Jew look like. These Celts come from the territory that the ten tribes moved to. Give me a better reason. They're not like the people who swarm in out of Asia in the Mongol invasion that followed. Attila the Hun and his counterparts and the Slavic nations that pushed in out of North and Eastern Russia and Siberia. These people have all the characteristics in appearance that can fit the tribes of Israel. They have an amalgam of Phoenician deities and Hebrew deities. They encounter the Greek language and they spell it backwards like Hebrew. The Sumerians worship a deified leader whose name and attributes match Moses. I no longer dangle on that subject. There's only one sensible explanation for the origin of the Celts. The ten tribes north of the Caucasus, viewed by a new bunch of strangers, get a name and a description, Cimmerians and Scythians, as the Persians called them Saki or Sakasuni, sons of Isaac, as the Assyrians called them Beit Kumri, after the sixth king of Israel who founded the city and capital of Samaria, and they become the Kimri, Cimri, or Sumerians. The Greeks now call them Scythians because they wonder. But there's a trail that's left. I'm going to beat this to death a little bit. Bilhah, the handmaid of Rachel, one of Jacob's two wives, bare unto Jacob two sons, Dan and Naphtali. The meaning of Dan, as you know, and I've been over this in Hebrew, is to judge. Now, to judge does not just mean to sit, as I've told you before, and pass judgment, guilty or innocent, on a criminal. Civil judges and civil acts of judges outnumber criminal acts. If you get a search warrant, you're going to have a judge's signature on it. It becomes a stamp of authenticity. It becomes a designation for an evidentiary record. To judge is to more than say, you're guilty, sentence 3 years, you're innocent. It is to conduct an official duty of designating accuracy, among other things, validity of a record, identifying exhibits. All of that is embraced in judging. Now, when the Scripture says in Genesis 49, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel, that's the quote in the King James. Just as literally you could say, Dan shall Dan his people. Because that's what the word means. You could translate Genesis 49:16 these following ways. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Judge shall Dan his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall Dan his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Judge shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. You got them all four? Same word. Dan shall judge his people. Judge shall Dan his people. Dan shall Dan his people. Judge shall judge his people. All four are accurate. The seal or stamp or signature or mark of Dan is an authentic designation. It is his people. Now, we've seen God's prophecies carried out every time in spite of his people. Dan has this assignment in prophecy. As the scepter will not depart from Judah, as the birthright will not depart from Joseph, the task of Danning will not depart from Dan. Where can we get a certificate that this is really a tribe of Israel? Go to the judge. Get his stamp. Okay, Dan, will you Dan this city? Unless you pull your mind apart and understand what that word means, you'll never see the significance of something that causes the critics of the British Israelites to go to extremes. In an earlier hour, I talked about brothers who demanded the King of England to turn his throne over to him and got committed to an insane asylum. But don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. What in the world does it mean when it says, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel? Nowhere in the Bible do you find Dan setting up a judicial system, a judiciary. It has to have another kind of meaning. The authenticating task, the designating task, the identifying task. The way a judge says, all right, clerk, designate plaintiff's exhibit number one, mark it, blah, blah, blah. That settles it, friend. The judge puts it into the record. Dan shall Dan his people. Second, that same prophecy says, Dan shall be a serpent, by the way, an adder in the path, that biteth the horse heels so that his rider shall fall backward. Let me save that horse heels bit. Just talk about the serpent bit right now. Leave a serpent's trail is an equally accurate translation. Dan shall, this is a permissible translation, certify his people. Designate. Shall leave a serpent's trail. And the prophecy says Dan will wait for salvation. Haven't you ever wondered why Dan is left out of the list in the book of Revelations when the 144,000 are chosen? Now, some people have them such terrible people they don't make it in the millennium. Wait a minute. Go read Ezekiel. When Ezekiel lays out the territory, beginning with the revised worship during the millennium period in Ezekiel 40 and onward, the time of that prince we haven't yet identified, the land is laid out, including land for the prince, as if Jesus would need any. That prince is not Jesus, I'll tell you that much. That prince in those last chapters of Ezekiel. But there's a territory for Dan, so don't you leave them out. But they have to wait for their salvation. Now that's a dangler for you. Dan is going to Dan his people. Dan leaves a serpent's trail. Wherever Dan goes, he leaves his mark. And Dan has to wait for his salvation. and he bites horses' heels. We'll leave that. Deuteronomy 33 has another promise about Dan. Of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's whelp. 22nd verse, Deuteronomy 33. He shall leap from Bashan. Now let's look at Dan. Can we look at Dan? Joshua 19, verses 40 to 48. Joshua divided the land, and to the Danites, he gave a portion that lay along the Mediterranean coast. You know how the tribes had it laid out in that Mediterranean area. Egypt's down here. Jordan River, Dead Sea. Judah gets its section, and then Benjamin with Jerusalem in it. Dan ends up with a little territory down here, plus some other territory. This is territory to the south of Judah. They never really conquered the land. The coast, it says, of the children of Dan went too little for them. Therefore the children of Dan went out to fight against Leshem and took it, and smote it with the edge of the sword and possessed it, and dwelt therein, and called Leshem, Laish, it was in Judges 18, Dan, after the name of their father. Now here you have an attribute. They attack a place, and they rename it. Now in the 18th chapter of Judges, another account. In those days, there was no king in Israel. In those days, the tribe of the Danites sought them an inheritance to dwell in. For unto that day, all their inheritance had not fallen unto them among the tribes of Israel. They sent some scouts out from the tribe of Dan to the far northern border of Israel, to a city called Laish, verse 7. Later on they conquer it. And Judges 18:29 said they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born unto Israel. Howbeit the name of the city was Laish at the first. Now that, in the mouth of two witnesses, the Scripture says a thing is confirmed, right? Twice they go to a place not assigned them by Joshua. They conquer the place, and they put their stamp on it. They name it Dan. We know in the days of Deborah, when she was fighting Sisera, and those 10,000 men crashed down off of what is called Mount Tabor in Israel today to win that great victory, Deborah asked the question, why did Dan remain in her ships? So you get these little clues. Dan is to leap from Bashan. That means, and the words literally mean a long and sudden leap. Dan doesn't conquer its territory south of Judah. Goes looking for other spots, and when they conquer them, they name them Dan. And they're a seafaring people. Now watch. In order for one to get to the Black Sea by ship, around which the other tribes were settled, he passes from the Aegean Sea through the Dardanelles. If he were to walk counterclockwise from the east end of the Black Sea, he would pass by the mouths of the following rivers. Get your map out and you'll see this. By the time he got completely around the Black Sea, Now, if Dan is to certify and the stamp and the mark, that's a big if, but it's an allowable if. And if the tribes have settled around the Black Sea, and if they are seafaring people and tend to put their mark wherever they land, just go around hunting these tribes now through the Dardanelles. And as you go around the Black Sea, where these tribes have settled now, you will pass the Don River, the Donets River, the Dnieper River, the Dniester River, the Danube River. More of these accidents, you know. Interesting little accidents. Now, when you understand what you that have been listening know, because I'm no longer dangling at this point, there were no vowels in the Hebrew language. D and N is all you had. You learn by oral transmission how to pronounce it. But this tribe of Dan could equally be called Dan, Don, Din, Dan, Dun. You would really have some foreigner try to pronounce it if you just had D-N with no vowel in between. Strange sounding word. Now let's look at these rivers again. The Don, the Donets, the Dnieper, the Dniester, the Danube. Isn't that interesting? Seafaring people, the judge or certifier of Israel, the habit pattern witnessed in Scripture of naming the places they land or settle after their father, Dan, prophesied to leave a serpent's trail or a mark so they can be followed wherever they go. If one will follow the Danube River in its westerly or northwesterly course, it will take him upstream into the heart of Europe. From here, if one leaves the Danube and takes a somewhat northerly direction, when he gets to the point where the Danube flows through Vienna, Austria, he will come to Danzig, a city situated on the Baltic coast of north-central Poland. How about Gdansk? One continues to follow the coast of the Baltic Sea in a westward direction. He will soon come to Denmark, meaning Dan's mark. Following the coastline, a seafaring people dwelling in ships. Still further west to southwest from Denmark, one soon arrives at a city in northern France called Dunkirk. From Dunkirk, one can cross the English Channel to the British Isles, where he will encounter scores of cities, rivers, and bays with the name Dan, Din, Din, Don, Dun, and a people who settled with circular forts by the hundreds called Duns. It is in Ireland, however, where one will notice the largest number of these words with some form of the word Dan in them. Dungiven, and done after done after done, as I've said. An interesting thing about the name of Dan, this writer points out, it found almost exclusively on rivers and lakes and long coastlines. Dan abode in ships, a seafaring people. Almost never an alpine area. Why did Dan, Deborah asked, remain in ships? This focuses, as this writer says, on the fact that both scriptures and early secular history make it very clear that the people of Dan were a great seafaring people. The city of Joppa, in the territory of Dan's inheritance as given out by Joshua, must have been a seaport of some importance. It was at Joppa that Jonah boarded a ship for Tarshish or Spain. They had close ties with the Phoenicians. They conquered the city of Laish and renamed it after their father Dan. You look at a map, you'll notice that Laish, renamed after the children of Dan, named after their father, lay only 25 miles due east of the city of Tyre. You should be used to the map of that area after the siege of Beirut. The city of Tyre was rapidly to become the New York of the ancient world, the most important maritime city in the area, the home of the Phoenicians, the king of which gave his daughter to Ahab at the time of the greatest idolatry among the 10 tribes. Jezebel was a Phoenician, daughter of the Phoenician king. And the Danites moved to within 25 miles of Tyre and blended their seafaring activities with the Phoenicians. Now, who are the Phoenicians? Where did they come from? Hang that up there for a minute. Let me just raise a possible question. No, I won't. Now, these Danites who came out of Egypt with Moses, descendants of their father Dan, were not the only Danites. They received a small territory south of Judah that they never conquered and from which they went looking for other territories. They tended to look in certain areas for a reason. According to secular history, not biblical, some of the adventurous, seafaring Danites left Egypt even before the exodus of the people of Israel and migrated to Greece. They settled in the extreme southern part of Greece and were later known as the Lacedaemonians. I went by that fast. Or Spartan Greeks. Let's look at this word, Lacedaemonians. These were the Spartans' ancestors. They were also known as Dorians, or people from Dor. Now, look on your ancient Bible maps. Dor was a prominent city in the territory given to the tribe of Manasseh. Manasseh had two territories also. A half-tribe was on the east side of the Jordan River, north of the territory of the tribes of Reuben and Gad. Wish I had a place to put this on a wall. And they had another seafaring territory. Dor was in the territory of the tribe of Manasseh, on the Mediterranean coast. It was from this city that many Israelites, under the pressure of multiplied attacks by the Assyrians, left the promised land in order to settle in the southern part of Greece as Dorians. Now, here's a secular historian writing in 50 B.C., Diodorus Siculus. He quoted Hecataeus of Abdera, who had written in the 6th century B.C., saying that the most distinguished of the expelled foreigners from Egypt. Now, you've been listening to me for a long time. I got a lot of dangles out there. Remember that? How come in the genealogy of Matthew, they just name Zara and then leave him? How come that strange story of the birth of Perez and Zara from Judah in the book of Genesis that we covered. What part are the descendants of Zara who equally deserve the scepter promised to Judah as Perez? Indeed, more so, because in that strange story in Genesis, the hand of Zara came out first. He was the firstborn. A scarlet cord was tied by the midwife around the wrist of Zara, and he pulls the hand in, and Perez is born, and she names him Breach. Zara, by right of primogeniture, unless he forfeited that right by sins that denied him the passage of his rights from Judah, Zara was the proper descendant, deserving the birthright portion promise, which was the scepter, rulership. Yet through Perez comes the rulership, through David, to Christ. That takes nothing away from Christ's rights, because the covenant reiterated to David makes Jesus, more usually referred to as the seed of David, and the reiterated covenant of David fulfilled the promise to Judah, but God was not limited to Perez and the David line to keep his promise to Judah when he said, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." There will always be a throne with a king on it over God's people Israel out of Judah. Zara qualifies. Now, we have traced that family of so-called shepherds in the latter part of Genesis when Jacob moved down to Egypt. We've seen him bless Pharaoh, an insult unless he were of greater stature of respect. And Pharaoh willingly accepts his blessing. They're asked to identify themselves, and they say, "We be shepherds." Now, there was an ancient history of shepherd kings. But at the time, on the date lines that Jacob's family moved to Egypt and Joseph sat in rulership position in Egypt, is exactly the date of those mysterious Hyksos shepherd kings, foreign rulers, who without a war came to rule Egypt until the southern kingdom overthrew them about 100 years, or at the minimum 40 years, before Moses rose up to deliver them. Those shepherd kings were none other than the house of Joseph, who without conquering Egypt came to rule over it and came to be hated in the later successors by the Egyptians. They were not 400 years in bondage in Egypt. They only went into bondage when a king rose up that knew not Joseph, and the Hyksos were thrown out. Now, Judah was the ruling line. And when the Hyksos were thrown out, some left the territory, some stayed in bondage. In addition, others, while the descendants of Jacob were ruling in Egypt, took advantage of that position. Diodorus Siculus quoted Hecateus of Abdera in the 6th century, saying the most distinguished of the expelled foreigners from Egypt, the Hyksos being thrown out, followed Cadmus and Danaus. Interesting. Danaus. Another name. Danaus and Cadmus into Greece. But the greater number, by this ancient heathen historian, the greater number, it says, were supposed to have been led by Moses into the Promised Land. Diodorus of Sicily keeps that record in his book 5. Now, the tribe of Dan is not mentioned in the genealogical list as given in 1 Chronicles 5. We've been through that. That's where, again, it's repeated that Joseph has the birthright, Judah has the scepter. But you turn to the accounts of the captivity of Israel found in 2 Kings, chapters 15 and 17, you will see that the name of Dan is not mentioned a single time among those peoples who were carried into the captivities of 741 to 721 B.C. That's a little thought we haven't thrown at you before. The 10 tribes were carried into bondage from about the middle of the 8th century, 741 B.C., to the biggest defeat when Samaria fell in 721 B.C., to the finished mop-up work in the next 20 years or so, and the 10 tribes are wiped out. You have the half-tribe of Manasseh and Reuben and Gad carried into bondage first, because as the Assyrians come crashing down into this territory, the half-tribe of Manasseh and Reuben and Gad are on the east side of this Jordan River. They're carried first into bondage and settled among the Medes. Then in successive waves, the rest of them are taken. And then as we saw last time we were on this subject, more than 200,000 from Judah are carried into the same territory. So both the Jews and the tribes of the north have people carried and resettled in Assyria, though Jerusalem did not fall as prophesied by Isaiah in the days of Hezekiah. All that detail, even the specific detail of 200,000 being carried out of Judah and all the tribes of the northern kingdom carried into bondage, not one mention of Dan. Not once. They're a seafaring people who know in the time where the tribes went. They have relatives who left Egypt before the Moses group ever went out. And they are seeking out their people and danning them and leaving a serpent trail. They know because they can have the same information that Esdras had, that the tribes that were carried into bondage, some of them moved around the southern side of the Black Sea and up into the Sumerian area. The vast host of them went through the Caucasus Mountains and settled near Ar-Sharet, hill or city of Sereth in the southern Russian steppe lands. Now, they're still like the Phoenicians, plying all the rivers and all the coastlines. They're not carried into bondage because they leaped from Bashan in a great sudden leap. They saw it coming. You'll search in vain for them among the tribes carried into bondage. They had mixed with the Phoenicians of Tyre and were on their ships. Who were the Phoenicians? In fact, you will search in vain to find the Danites mentioned anymore as a tribe in any of the biblical accounts of the people of Israel from the time of the Judges to the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. What happened to Dan? Where did Dan go? Now, the Bible doesn't specifically say, did the Danites leave hastily? Or did the leap from Bashan that was prophesied mean ships? Where'd they go? Herodotus, called the father of history, that Greek ancient historian, writing in the 5th century B.C., speaks also of an Egyptian origin of some of the Greeks. He says, quote, if we ascend from Danai, the daughter of Crissus, we shall find that the ancestors of Dorian princes were of Egyptian origin. Such is the Grecian account of the descent. That's in his book 6. And also in book 1. Chapter 3. Remember, these Greek Dorians, as I've already pointed out, had come over from the territory given to the tribe of Manasseh, where some of the Danites had settled, and there were Greek Dorians that had settled also, having left Egypt before Moses in the Exodus time. And a number of historians, in addition to Herodotus, refer to these Egyptian Danai. Herodotus says in book 6, chapter 4, another place, quote, in what manner, being Egyptians, they became princes of the Dorians, having been mentioned by others, I need not relate, But I shall explain what they've omitted. Where did these Danites go? They're marking and certifying the tribes of Israel. They're following the coasts. They're following the rivers. They have all the skills of the seafaring Phoenicians who went around the Cape of Africa, all up the eastern side of Africa, into the Persian Gulf, all around the Mediterranean, around the point of Spain, and up into the north and through all the rivers, leaving their mark, Dan's mark. We know that some of them settled in Greece, some settled in Dan's mark or Denmark, and then we end up in that little place called Ireland with people trying to tell you that the Tuatha De Danann Tuatha meaning tribe of Danann, you'll have what I call illiterate literates telling you this has to mean a tribe who worshiped the great goddess Dana. Hogwash and pickle juice. Why is it so hard to consider a people who name themselves Tuatha De Danann, tribe of Dan, why can't they be called tribe of Dan? Why do people complicate things? Wherever they go, they leave their mark, and they finally settle, and they're the Tuatha De Danann. Well, I can't figure out who they are. There's too much water between there and Israel. They were not great swimmers. They abode in ships, Deborah said. Where do you think Solomon got his tin? He had great wealth of tin. Now, you're over 80 years old, Stan. Does it take too much brains to figure out that tribe of Dan simply means tribe of Dan? Why do we have to create some dumb goddess I've never been able to find called Donna? The annals of Ireland read, the Danann were a highly civilized people, well skilled in architecture and other arts from their long residence in Greece and their intercourse with the Phoenicians. Their first appearance in Ireland was 1200 B.C., or 85 years after the great victory of Deborah. You want to read that again? From the annals of Ireland, we read, the Danann were a highly civilized people, well skilled in architecture and other arts from their long residence in Greece. We just found out a leader named Danis settled in Greece and became the Spartans. By the way, you know who founded Athens? Dangle, dangle. They're seafaring. They dwell in ships. They leave their mark everywhere they go. They finally settle in a territory and conquer it themselves. A small coastal area that's the last jumping off place before you head across the Atlantic Ocean. And they call themselves the Tuatha De Danann, the tribe of Dan. Why is it that the mind fights against that designation? And the annals of Ireland say they were highly civilized, skilled in architecture and other arts from their long residence in Greece and their intercourse with the Phoenicians. They settled the city and named it after their father, 25 miles from the capital city of the Phoenicians. Their first appearance in Ireland was 1200 B.C., 85 years after the great victory of Deborah, when Deborah complained because none of them were fighting with her because they all abode in the ships. Now, you believe what you want. I think they were the tribe of Dan. Josephus gives an account showing that at least some of the Lacedaemonian Greeks were Danites and were therefore related to the Jews. At the time when Onias was high priest in Jerusalem, Arius, the Lacedaemonian king, sent an embassage with a letter to the Jewish high priest. In the letter, it reads as follows. I read this to you months ago directly from Josephus. Arius, king of the Lacedaemonians, to Onias, sendeth greeting. We have met with a certain writing whereby we have discovered that both the Jews and the Lacedaemonians are of one stock and are derived from the kindred of Abraham. It is but just, therefore, that you who are our brethren should send to us about any of your concerns as you please. We will also do the same thing and esteem your concerns as our own, and will look upon our concerns as in common with yours. Demoteles, who brings you this letter, will bring your answer back to us. This letter is foursquare, and the seal is an eagle with a dragon in its claws, or a snake in its claws. Interestingly enough, the tribal emblem or ensign of Dan contained the image of a snake. I thought this would interest you. As someone else is saying, what we've been saying as we traced it in record after record, that these Danites or sea rovers settled all through this territory as they certified the tribes of Israel. Moore, in his History of Ireland, says concerning the takeover of Ireland by the Tuatha De Danann, their tenure of royalty, the Firbolgs, who were conquered by the Tuatha De Danann, was but short. When the Tuatha De Danann landed in Ireland, the Firbolgs were there. Their tenure, the Firbolgs, was short. Not more than 30 or 40 years had it remained in their hands. They were dispossessed by the Tuatha De Danann, the tribe of Dan, a people famed for necromancy, magic works, and the occult, who after sojourning for some time in Greece, where they had learned this mysterious art, proceeded from thence to Denmark, Dansmark, and Norway, and then to Ireland. That's Moore's History of Ireland. He's not a British Israelite. Dr. Robert Gordon Latham, 19th century ethnologist, definitely believed the Greek Danans were descendants of Dan. He says, neither do I think that the eponymous or the ancestral name of the Argive Danai was other than that of the Israelite tribe of Dan. You know who the Argives were in ancient history of Greece? Founders of its most powerful territory. The Argive Danai, I do not think that the ancestral name of the Argive Danai was other than that of the Israelite tribe of Dan. Only we are so used to confine ourselves to the soil of Palestine in our consideration of the history of Israelites. He goes on to show that the people of Dan must have had close connections with the peoples of southern Greece, and concludes by saying, quote, yet with Danai and the tribe of Dan, this is the case, and no one connects them. So you have the tribes of Dan before Moses ever leaves, as well as Zara's sons, several of whom we will yet trace. You have a contingent of the tribe of Dan settling in the Aegean area and in the territory of Troy, where other relatives had settled, they tend to follow the sons of Zara wherever they went. And they're always moving around and marking the spots with their name where the descendants of Jacob have settled. So when some of them leave Egypt early to found Troy, as we've seen in other teachings earlier, others settle among the Greeks, you find the Danites following suit and going and leaving their mark wherever they go, and ultimately going to Denmark and back to Ireland as the Tuatha De Danann. And tell me that God can't find those tribes? God's always known where they were. The Persians knew who they were. They were the sons of Isaac, Sakasuni. The Assyrians knew where they were, and they knew who they were. They were the house of Cumri, to become the Sumerians and the Scythians, wandering tribes. And the tribes of Dan knew where they were, seafaring in nature. They followed their people everywhere they went and certified them as God had prophesied, to end up ultimately as the Tuatha De Danann, ultimately deified as a princely people in the land of Ireland. And they were there when the Miletians arrived. Who were the Miletians? Come on up, Sammy, and sing. It's 10 o'clock. I hope I'm not boring you on the tribes. You getting bored? The histories of Ireland are replete with references to the Tuatha De Danann who had come to Ireland from Greece. Mueller, commenting on some of the fragments of the Greek manuscripts of Hecateus of Abdera, says, quote, Hecateus therefore tells us that the Egyptians, formerly being, this is not a biblical source, Fragmenta Historicorum Graecorum, Volume 2, page 385. Hecateus therefore tells us that the Egyptians, formerly being troubled by calamities, referring to the 10 plagues at the time of the Israelitish Exodus, in order that the divine wrath might be averted, expelled all the aliens gathered together in Egypt. Of these, some under their leaders, Danis and Cadmus, migrated into Greece, others into other regions, the greater part into Syria, their term for all of Palestine. Their leader is said to have been Moses, a man renowned for wisdom and courage, founder and legislator of the state. Afterwards, many Mosaic institutes followed. Now, this is a quote from the Greek manuscript of Hecateus of Abdera, who references the Egyptian reaction to plagues and the exodus of people, the majority of whom went with Moses, but some left during the time of trouble under Danis and Cadmus. Both Hecateus of Abdera, 3rd century B.C., and Diodorus of Sicily mention that the people of Danai, under their leader Danis, came from Egypt. But Hecateus says that the greater part of the Danites went into Syria or Palestine under the leadership of Moses. Now you'll understand why the Danites, who had many of their brethren settled in other places, would rather get in ships and go find their brethren than fight the Philistines. And they became the wanderers, leaving a serpent's trail. Diodorus of Sicily has this to say. They say also that those who set forth with Danis, likewise from Egypt, settled what is practically the oldest city of Greece, Argos, and that the nations of the Colchian Pontus and that of the Jews, which lies between Arabia and Syria, were founded as colonies by certain immigrants from their country, and this is the reason why it is a long-established institution among these two people in Greece, Argos, Colchian Pontus, and the area of the Jews. This is the reason why it's a long-established institution among these two people to circumcise their male children, the custom having been brought over from Egypt. Diodorus of Sicily, Book 1, Section 18, pages 1 to 5. Now, in the 1800s, as we begin to dig in archaeological finds, and as the medieval pressures were lifted for opening the doorway of knowledge and forbidden books could be read for a change, the record is clear. These tribes were never lost at any time to history. And they settled, after marking the tribes in various places, a major contingent of the Tuatha de Danann, the tribe of Dan, conquered the Firbolgs and settled in Ireland. Then came the Milesians. Who were they? Huh? See you tomorrow night, 8 o'clock. I'd go to the rock, Sammy. Let it go. I didn't let you sing the whole song earlier. Now you can have